Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start with Dak Prescott. Dak signed his exclusive franchise tender yesterday. Now, you know me. There's nothing that I like more than talking franchise tags, tenders, exclusive, non-exclusive, all the above. This is where I live. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is like Christmas in June for me. So you know I'm fired up to talk about this story. Yeah, anyway, Prescott signed the $31.4 million tender yesterday. Then he posted a photo of himself in a cowboy hat on Instagram. So that means that the Dak Prescott contract saga, which has run for more than a year, is finally over, right? This means we will never have to hear Jerry Jones make some weird analogy about contract negotiations and a gruesome car accident where you bleed out in the woods, right? It's finally over, right? Wrong.
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 Not a very good call.
I know what you're thinking. Hey, Rome, he just signed a deal. It's got to be the end of this, right? No, it's not. For Jera and Steva and the boys, they still have they still do not have a long-term deal done. And they're still on the clock. Jera and Steva have until July 15th to hammer that deal out. So this isn't the deal. At best, it's the deal that leads to the deal. And it means that dopes can keep on talking about this for another 3 weeks. Fantastic. I mean, truly and incredibly fantastic. It means that maybe we can have three more weeks of Jerry Jones doing stuff like this.
Picture if you were a driver of a car and you had a wreck and your hand was almost severed off, but you didn't understand your anatomy. You look down, you're spurting blood. You open the door and run to the woods and either die bleeding to death or shock. The educated man looks down, knows his anatomy, squeezes and knows his best chance is to wait for help. That's because he's been there a lot and done that. And so I'm waiting, I'm squeezing and waiting for help.
That is actually, honestly, one of the most amazing analogies ever. The educated man knows his anatomy. The uneducated man does not. I don't know, Jera. Three more weeks of people trying to compare Dak's numbers to the numbers of other quarterbacks and then trying to come up with some argument for why he is or is not worth what the market says he's worth. Three more weeks of Russell Wilson got this, so Dak should get that. Or Prescott v. Goff, compare and contrast. Or Prescott v. Cousins, who you got? Three more weeks of junior capologists trying to come up with the perfect number for Dak or speculating on what the cap is going to be next year if there is a dip because of COVID and how that's going to impact the Cowboys. Let me make this very simple. Yet again. How many times have we gone over this? Dak Prescott deserves what the market says he deserves. Nothing less. All that crap about him being asked to take less because he's the starting quarterback of the Cowboys and make it up in endorsements is just that. It's crap. There are two teams in the NFL. Two types. Teams who have a starting quarterback and those who do not. You can't do anything in this league without a legitimate starting quarterback. Everybody who doesn't have one is chasing one. Those who do have one are lucky. They are fortunate. And you have to pay for that luck and that good fortune. Quickly, fingers on the buzzers. How much of the Cowboys paid Dak Prescott in his first 4 years? Year during that same time.
Hey!
In other words, the Cowboys got a complete and total steal for the first 4 years. Now is the time to pay up. They should be thrilled to be signing a long-term deal with Dak. They should be falling all over themselves to sign that deal. They should be saying, hey, Dak, here's a blank check. We've signed it. You go ahead and fill in whatever you want, and we'll go from there. And no, don't come at me and talking about or to talk about contracts for Ezekiel Elliott and Amari Cooper and talk about the salary cap. First off, as we have talked about in the past, the salary cap is an artificial construct. Jerry Jones is worth billions. So is pretty much every other NFL team owner. They created the salary cap, and then they throw their hands up in the air and say, whoa, this salary cap really ties my hands together. I can't afford to pay everybody. All right. All right. Then get rid of the cap. But of course, that's never going to happen. But you can't tell me the Cowboys didn't know about the salary cap or that they haven't done the math on how to keep the guys they want to keep. And if you can't keep them, if you get yourself into a jam, that's on you. That's not on Dak. It's not his job to bail you out. It's your job to pay him what he's worth. And again, and let me say this one more time, and you get to do that. You have the privilege of having a starting quarterback and one that you found in the fourth round. You caught lightning in a bottle. He has been an absolute bargain. So now you get to pay him. There are a dozen other teams that would happily pay him. If you think you can do better for less money, then by all means, let this guy walk. But if you don't think you can do that, if you do not have the guts to do that, then pay the guy. Pay him what he's worth. Quit complaining. As big of a deal as Dak can get, it's still just walk around money for Jerry. It's pocket change for Jarrah. Sign the deal and let's keep moving. You know, the thing that you could have and should have done a long time ago. And you know what I hope? I hope it really is only 3 more weeks of this nonsense. Because this thing could play out and could string out year to year like Kirk Cousins. And then we're talking about several more years of this nonsense. Hopefully it is only 3 more weeks and they get that deal done by the deadline. Tell me we don't have to go over this again. How many times have I gone over this already? 1-800-636-8686.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean, Jarrah. You and Steva both know what I mean. You know what I mean. He is Sam Amick. Now, Sam, it's been a minute or two since you and I have spoken. Before we get into everything, Sam, bring me up to date. How are you? How is everybody around you? And what's it been like having a spring without basketball, Sam?
Romy, great to be with you. Been a long time. Thank you, as always. We're hanging in. You know, as you know, I'm outside of Sacramento. We got a sleepy little suburb with a decent setup where I, you know, live at the end of a court and can stretch our legs a little bit and you know, say hello to our neighbors. But it's been incredibly weird and surreal because, as you know, we're creatures of habit. And so for the last 10 years, I guess, for me, it's been mid-April to mid-June, you know, jumping on planes, going all over the country, covering the playoffs and saying goodbye to the family, but then popping home every week or so to change your luggage and get out on the road again. And next thing you know, it's a lot of what I got right now. I'm sitting on my patio, making calls, got the laptop out and just playing the waiting game. So, I mean, we're happy to be healthy, but certainly a weird time.
That is so well said. Sam Amick joining us. It's good to hear your voice, too, Sam. Good to have you back. Now, earlier this month, you wrote a piece that the NBA is resetting and that you are nervous. Before we talk about the increasing number of COVID cases in Florida and other parts around the country, what were your initial concerns about the league's plan?
Well, I mean, they're the same then as they are now. Now it's just you have the thing that a lot of people feared, which is that the rise in cases in that part of Florida. For the first month or so, when we started learning that the NBA was headed to Orlando, you would look at the Orange County numbers in Florida and you would have a little bit of a sigh of relief because they were not nearly as bad as the other hotspots within the state. And now that's changed and the timing couldn't be worse. And you know, the NBA, I do think, has gone to incredibly exhaustive lengths to try to create the safest environment possible. But as others have certainly said, it's not a bubble. You know, it's just that phrasing is not accurate. You're going to have Disney employees that are able to come and go while going home every night and then trying to keep their distance from the players when they're in there. And so you're going to have an element of risk, even though they are trying, you know, their best to mitigate it. So the nervousness is just that I understand from a business standpoint why they're doing this, and I'm also living it. I work for a company that definitely benefits from sports taking place. But if they get on the back end of this and you have serious, you know, kind of illness and sickness, or God forbid, loss of life, then, you know, you don't want to have to look back at this period and say, no, they just made the wrong move.
Hey, listen up. When you're working from home or you're working on your fitness, you want to make sure that what you're listening to is what you're listening to and not what your roommates or neighbors or a significant other or kids are listening to. Everybody needs a great pair of wireless earbuds. But before you go dropping hundreds of bucks on a pair, make sure you check out the wireless earbuds from Raycon. Now, you already know that Raycon earbuds start at about half the price of any other premium wireless earbuds on the market. But they sound just as amazing as the other top audio brands that you know of. Now, check this. Their newest model, the Everyday E25 earbuds, are their best ones yet. 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design that gives you a nice noise-isolating fit. They're amazing. And they're so comfortable, they're perfect for conference calls or binging podcasts. All those things together, plus the price and the value, make them a game changer for me. And unlike some of the other wireless options, Raycon earbuds are both stylish and discreet. There are no dangling wires or stems to distract anybody during video calls. You've heard me talk about how the company was co-founded by Ray J and celebrities like Snoop Dogg, J.R. Smith, Melissa Etheridge. They're all obsessed with their Raycons. Pick up a pair, find out what the hype's all about. Now is the time to get the latest and the greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off your order at buyraycon.com/Rome. Again, buyraycon.com/Rome. Get 15% off. I've got my pair. Get yours. Buyraycon.com/Rome. Sam Amick is joining us. Back to that notion of they've got a business to run, of course. Like, the league might want to present this, Sam, as the resumption of the league is a civil service or an opportunity to get closure on the season. But as you've written, the playoffs alone could be worth roughly $900 million. How much of this is just about money?
Yeah, no, that's the vast majority of it. I mean, if they just wanted to keep the players active, there's other ways to do that in their home markets. This is about recouping revenue. You know, that's just the national TV money alone, the figure that you're referencing. You know, their $24 billion contract over 9 years with ESPN and TNT. Then you get into the regional sports network money, which that is why you're seeing 8 regular season games in addition to the playoffs. And there's definitely teams that are frustrated by that and feel like that's unnecessary, but that's another way to recoup revenue. And then you have the ripple effect of next season, the season after that, for the players and the owners, where obviously if they didn't try to do this, if they just, you know, decided to not come back until next season, whether it was mid-December or wherever it might be, you know, then you're going to have a devastating effect on the basketball-related income that they all share. And the business itself would be in very bad shape. But again, it's obviously a microcosm of what everybody in society is having to ponder, is that balance between health and economy and trying to make those two things work.
Exactly right. Sam Amick is joining us. We're talking about the resumption of the NBA season. Sam, Pat Beverly had that tweet that essentially said it all comes down to what LeBron James wants to do. The sense is he wants to play. Like, how significant is that? For instance, if LeBron thought that it was a bad idea to be playing, would you and I even be talking about the season being resumed?
No, I don't think so. That would be a non-starter. Adam Silver is, I would argue, that he's the most player-friendly commissioner in the history of the league, and he cares deeply about his relationship and his rapport, specifically with the superstars. And if LeBron, at this stage of his career, as kind of a living legend, came up to Adam and said, I'm not feeling it, I think that would be a major, major obstacle, and would not surprise me at all at that point if Adam then pivoted and they didn't do this. But LeBron, a couple of weeks ago, chose not to be on that player call where 80-plus players expressed concern, and the real focus was their ability to be heard on the social justice front and pushing for police reform, things of that nature. LeBron not being on that call, I think, spoke volumes, which is two things. For one, he's created, to his credit, his own ecosystem when it comes to making an impact off the court, and honestly is now reaping the benefits of that ecosystem, meaning that he can still play ball and have serious impact. They just announced something today from the voting rights group that he is heading with Draymond Green and players like that, where, you know, he's making change, but he can still do his day job. And he feels like, on top of that, you have the microphone from ESPN, TNT, ABC that for 4 months players could be heard on these issues. And so his stance is pretty clear, and he certainly respects, I was told, everybody else's views. But if he was on that call, if he was banging the drum to not play, you're 100% right. I don't think it would be happening.
We're talking to Sam Amick. Hey, Sam, one of the more controversial elements of the resumption plan is the ring or the magic band the players will be wearing. Like, if you're wearing a band and you're not allowed to leave, and there's a hotline for guys who want to snitch or rat on each other, at certain point, Sam, does this start to feel kind of creepy and uncomfortable?
Yeah, well, and it's a real issue in any time, and I think even more so right now. It's interesting, Romy, because if you go back about 2 months, Michelle Roberts, the executive president of the Players Union, had a quote that made the rounds, and to a lot of people just didn't land all that well at the time, where she compared this environment and this bubble attempt to incarceration. And at first, I'm just going to be honest, I thought it was hyperbole. But then as time has gone on, you see these themes and these elements that are potentially uncomfortable, not only for players, but for a league in which about 85% of the players are black. And it's bracelets, it's hotlines to snitch on people, it's even lifestyle stuff. If you're a 20-something-year-old single guy, and I'm not, I mean, don't get it twisted, this, in the grand scheme of things, this isn't that important, but these guys, they have their lives, and so now you're being asked to go into a bubble for 4 months, and if you're a family man, you can't see your family until after the first round, and if you're not, then you know it's even more problematic to have friends come in. It's just incredibly restrictive, and the bracelets have not been well received. There's been a lot of concern, skepticism, suspicion about what the true intent is of those. In fact, to add on to that, I had a doctor on our podcast yesterday, Angela Rasmussen from Columbia, talking about how, in her opinion, there's no real discernible evidence that the bracelets help you detect the virus any quicker than other means. And so I felt like that even added to the conversation. So a lot of layers to this thing, and player comfort, I think, is going to be a major issue in this next month as they get closer to getting to Orlando.
Sam Amick is a senior NBA writer for The Athletic. He joins me for a few more moments. Sam, Washington's Davis Bertans reportedly decided to sit out as a preventative measure ahead of being a free agent. What's your reaction to that news?
Not surprising. I mean, for one, the Wizards have less to play for than anybody in the entire 22-team group. As somebody pointed out to me yesterday, you're talking about a team that's 6 games back and you have 8 games to play on the docket. And I think potentially where the NBA might have missed the mark here is that you opened it up too much, whether it was 20 teams, whether it was 16 teams. Once you get to a team like the Wizards, you are just talking about very little incentive to not only play for somebody like Davis because of what he has on the line. He's going to be a free agent, expected to make, you know, double-digit millions of dollars per year on his next contract. But team-wide, if you're on that team, you let's say you drop your first game, drop your first 2 games, and now it's a wrap. Now you just have 6 meaningless games. You've been asked to come into this incredibly uncomfortable environment. And I definitely understand why certain guys wouldn't want to play, and especially with the kind of money on the line that a guy like Davis has.
Sam, I mentioned at the very top that you're the co-host of the Tampering Podcast. When you think about the fact that you're going to have teams in Orlando in 3 hotels, you've got the potential for a lot of interaction between players and team personnel. How much tampering do you think might go on there?
Well, my colleague and friend Ethan Sherwood-Strauss at The Athletic wrote a piece last week where an executive had coined the phrase tamper-palooza, and that's what he thought it would be out there. And I could see that for sure, because the structure of the 3 hotels is such that, like, if I end up going, which is a distinct possibility, and being on the inside, the media would be sequestered with a lot of NBA staff in 1 hotel. But then the team personnel and the types of GMs and front office executives who traffic in that space would be sharing the same hotel for a very long time. And they would, all of a sudden, from a kind of a daily routine standpoint, those other GMs, those other executives of rival teams would be on the very short list of human beings that they were allowed to interact with, that they were allowed to go to dinner with. It's a heck of a little kind of, you know, just experiment, I guess, in something we've never seen before. Because it's one thing to get a bunch of these people together in a Las Vegas Summer League setting where a lot of times those types of discussions happen, or All-Star Weekend. This is on a different level, and I think for sure you're going to have a lot of deal-making going on.
So, Sam, one last thought. Does all of this end after this season, or is there a possibility that next season begins without fans as well?
I definitely anticipate next season beginning without fans, and I think we won't have fans. And this is just me talking, but until there's a vaccine, if I had to handicap it. And now, again, I'm certainly not a medical expert. The doctor we had on yesterday was hopeful that by the end of the next calendar year, maybe we could be talking about a vaccine. But I just don't see how you have fans in any kind of worthwhile capacity until a vaccine isn't something that we all have. But for sure, I think at the start of next season, I don't expect to have fans.
Sam, just to reiterate, did the doctor tell you on your podcast that there may not be a vaccine until the end of next calendar year?
Correct, yeah. In fact, and really what struck me was also the reminder that there's no guarantee at all, ever, of, you know, and I think that's just kind of, you know, medical prudence, if you will. But she, Dr. Rasmussen, detailed the heavy lifting and the real specifics of what it takes to achieve a vaccine, and signing up thousands of people to take it and then letting them go out into society, signing up a few more thousand people, giving them a different vaccine, letting them go out in society, having to track them just to get to the answer of whether or not this vaccine works. I mean, it's just incredibly challenging work that is, you know, seems very uncertain. And, you know, I mean, really, in terms of history in this country, I believe the quickest we've ever gotten a vaccine is around 4 years, and technology has changed and hopefully sped that up. But I don't think there's any clarity on that front at all.
He is a senior NBA writer for The Athletic, co-host of the Tampering Podcast. No one better, Sam Amick. Sam, so good to have you back. Really appreciate it. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks, Romy. Be good, brother. Stay safe.
You too, Sam. Stay safe. The Miami Dolphins were on the clock at the NFL Draft, and they did something pretty awesome. Not that surprising. Despite all the misdirection that was being run, they did something pretty awesome. They selected Tua. They tossed the keys to the franchise to a 22-year-old stud out of Alabama, Tua. Interesting pick. Not just for the fish, but for pretty much every non-gambling football fan who never had a reason to watch the dreaded 10 a.m. Dolphins game on that tiny non-HD TV that's muted in the corner of the bar. It's been like that for a long time. But now, as part of the getting to know your new QB process, the Dolphins social media team conducted a virtual Q&A with Tua this week. And they set him up, put a few on a tee, lobbed him a few softballs. You know, like, Tua, who would you play, or who would you want to play you in a movie? Tua said, The Rock. They asked him, do you like pineapple on pizza? He said he does not. And what comes to mind when he thinks about Miami? He said, CSI. So not much to that, right? Nothing really to talk about, nothing to report. Pretty basic, pretty boring, pretty mundane. But then all of a sudden, the interview took a turn. The interview went viral during the following exchange about Tua's guilty pleasure music and his celebrity crush. Again, pretty benign questions. What's your guilty pleasure music and who is your celebrity crush? Except, and I need you to pardon the horribly obnoxious music bed that the Dolphins video editor decided to poison this clip with, and instead focus on what the 22-year-old said in both of those responses.
Favorite guilty pleasure singer?
I would say Shania Twain.
Who's your celebrity crush?
I'd probably go with Shania Twain, though. Shania, if you watch this, please message me back.
So who is your guilty pleasure singer? I'd probably say Shania Twain. Who is your celebrity crush? Yeah, I'd probably say Shania Twain. Though, Shania, if you watch this, please message me back. Hell yeah! Oh, hell yeah. Shooters shoot. Oh, hell yeah. Shooters shoot. Tua shot his shot. The 22-year-old kid just out of college, openly soliciting a message from his 54-year-old celebrity crush. So awesome. Especially awesome because the most recent interview that Tua did was on Twitter. And the most recent interview that Shania Twain did was in AARP, the magazine. And it was about her second marriage. I'm telling you, man, love knows no bounds or age gap. Ask Dennis Quaid. But speaking of Shania's second marriage, let's go ahead and pour one out for Mr. Shania Twain, Frederick Thebaud, because his wife went straight to social, retweeted to his answer, and wrote, quote, "Guilty pleasure? You should be proud of your good taste, Tua." And she even dropped in a kissing emoji for good measure. Dang, Frederick. Guess you don't impress your lady much anymore.
That don't impress me much. So yeah, got the moves.
Catchy little tune, right? Catchy little riff, right? Yeah, for the record, that song was written and went number one an entire year before Tua was born. But that doesn't matter because Tua's not messing around. Dude then responded to Shania's tweet and wrote back to her with her own lyrics. "You're still the one, Shania.
You're still the one I run to, the one that I belong to. You're still the one I want."
Hey man, I don't know if this guy knows that she's got a man, she's married to that man, or if he just doesn't give a damn. But now my dude is just going back and forth with her and tweeting her lyrics at her. I mean, this is an all-time exchange made possible only by social media, which so often sucks, but it can definitely have its moments, right? And this is one of those moments. You've got a dude 32 years younger than Shania Twain, right? He's only 22. He's 32 years younger than her. And he's fully admitting to crushing on her hard. One thing to do that, shooters shoot their shot, right? As we all know, it's not how many no's. It's not how many no's. I mean, don't you? We all respect the guy that just keeps coming, keeps coming, keeps coming. Because they know it's not how many no's, it's how many yeses. And you only need one big yes. One big yes can negate thousands of no's. And this guy just continues to come, right? Or not. He took one run at it, got a response almost instantly, and now they're in a full-blown conversation. Again, this is country music's all-time best-selling female artist ever. She's blowing kisses at this guy on Twitter. She's old enough to be his mother, and he's writing her own lyrics back to her, and she's responding. Like, Tua was a 70% passer in college. He's already leading the NFL with a perfect QBR. Before training camp, we don't even have a scheduled date for training camp. And he's got a perfect QBR. One attempt, one completion. And then poor Frederick is out there on ice skates getting burned on a go route. Sorry, Fred. Guess Tua just made your lady, yeah, I don't know, made your lady feel like a woman.
Man, I feel like a woman.
What do you feel like, Fred? Jeff and Southfield's written songs about you, Fred. One side note, I mean, forget Tua crushing on Twain. How about the fact that her songs from before he was born are heavy on his Spotify? I mean, I'm one of those boomers who's constantly saying, man, music was so much better then. Music had a melody then. Music was so much better then. But don't take it from me, old man Rome. Take it from young man Tua. He's got his songs in heavy rotation on Spotify from long before he was born. I mean, that's almost as awesome as the love story itself. My man is 22 years old, and he's bumping Shania Twain. He's bumping Twain instead of Drake or Kendrick or 21 Pilots or Billie Eilish. The Dolphins want the next Dan Marino. Well, they got a dude in 2020 who listens to music that came out when Marino was still under center. If Tua's quarterback game is half as good as his social game, the Finns have made their best pick since 83. Keep shooting, Tua, because right now you can't miss. Keep shooting, dude. Fish in a barrel. By hosting my radio show, I've learned one thing, if one thing only. There's not one single thing that we can all agree on, except for maybe this. Breakfast cereal rules. Am I right? Especially growing up, like cereal was one of the best parts about being a kid. Except as you grow up, you start to realize, man, maybe it's not the best thing. It was when I was a kid, but not anymore, because now I know that cereal is good because it's loaded with sugar and junk that I should not be pounding. Like many of you, I've tried to cut down on carbs and sugar and unhealthy grub. I mean, like I know now, I can't just eat what I want when I want. Which brings me back to Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon is what I want and what I need. Check these numbers out. Zero sugar, 12 grams of protein, only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. Check out these 4 flavors. Cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry. All of it is amazing. In fact, it tastes too good to be true. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. In other words, all the good stuff. I love it. Myself, I've been hammering the frosted. That's my go-to, and then blueberry. Speaking of go-to, go to magicspoon.com/Rome. Grab a variety pack, try it for yourself. Be sure to use our promo code Rome at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it is backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, and you will, but if you don't, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Magicspoon.com/Rome. Use the code Rome for free shipping. Magicspoon.com/Rome. I am pumped that Magic Spoon is a part of this podcast. He is Chris Kirk. He joins us now. Chris, great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
It's really good to have you. So, Chris, your journey is absolutely amazing, and I want to get into that in a moment. But first off, can you take me back to the weekend? Despite the fact that you had played bogey-free golf for the first 3 rounds and you were 21 under, you were 4 shots off the lead going into the final round. So let me start right there. What was your mindset as you went to the course?
Yeah, I definitely knew I was going to have to stay aggressive. Was very surprised when I finished my 3rd round to be 4 shots back after playing so well. I was just thinking I would try to go make as many birdies as I could and see if I could make a run.
So then you're 4 under on your first 7 holes. The leader is 2 over. Suddenly everything has changed. What was that like?
Yes, that was very unexpected. I felt good about being able to chase him down and catch him, but I certainly didn't think it was going to be on the 6th or 7th hole, like you said. But then obviously had a little stumble on number 10 and was able to right the ship a little bit and say, you know what, this is not about just me passing Vince, who was the leader, but you know, there were a ton of guys behind me that were all going to make a center birdie, so I knew I had to stay aggressive coming in, and thankfully was able to make 3 birdies right there at the end.
Chris Kirk joining us. So what about that? You had that stumble on 10, and that dropped you into a tie for the lead, but then you birdied 14 and 15. Then you had that short birdie putt on 18. You had not won since your win at Colonial back in 2015. So what kind of emotions were you feeling standing over that putt and then when it went in?
A lot of joy, really. That's one of the things in professional golf. You're standing back there in the fairway on 18, and you know you got to make a birdie on 18 to win to be able to do it, and thankfully do it relatively easily. I was glad it was a 2 or 3 footer, not a 12 footer, that's for sure. That's an amazing feeling to know you got to do it and be able to get it done.
We're talking to Chris Kirk. The thing is, Chris, that story alone is impressive, but it's even more impressive when you consider what you've done in the past 13 months. Last May, the day before your 34th birthday, you announced that you were going to take a leave of absence from the PGA Tour to address issues with alcohol abuse and depression. How would you describe your life at that point?
I think lost is probably the best word for it. So my sobriety date is April 29th, but the previous November was when I first, you know, sat down with some friends and family and address the issues, like, this is a problem for me, I'm going to stop drinking. And so that period of time from November through the end of April, beginning of May, I would usually make it for about three, four weeks or so, and just was miserable, unhappy. And then I finally would just go off the deep end. And that kind of kept repeating itself. And then after doing that a handful of times, I finally was just like, okay, I'm going to lose my family. I'm going to lose my career. I'm going to lose everything if I don't do something different here. And so that was when I said, okay, I just have to get away from the PGA Tour for a little while, away from traveling, away from golf, and was able to get the, really truly get the help that I needed at that point. Because I, being someone who's been always been very headstrong, very determined, I just thought that, I've got this. I can beat this just like anything else. But after that period of months, it became very clear that I couldn't do it on my own. So I'm very thankful that I stopped when I did, and have been successful to this point. And obviously, it's a long journey. It's a constant process, but I feel really great, and I'm excited about the future.
We're talking to Chris Kirk. I think I speak for a lot of people, Chris. I'm sure I do, that I really appreciate your candor, and I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you're an incredibly accomplished golfer. I mean, I only had time to list a few of your achievements at the start of the interview, but the fact is, you also finished second in the FedEx Cup in 2014. You were ranked in the top 20 in the world at one point, so it would have been understandable if you just kept battling it out on the course. What was it that made you step away?
I'd say it was a combination of a lot of things. First off, I was just miserable. Things were not going well at all in my personal life. Obviously, the stuff that I described was putting strain on the relationship with my wife and my kids and my family. And I just felt like I wasn't in control. And so I knew that if I didn't stop and I didn't do something about it, things were only going to get worse. And I just wasn't willing to keep going down that road. I'm very thankful that I was able to see that at that time. A lot of people are not as fortunate. They keep going until they've lost their family, until they've lost their job, they've lost their house, and it's that powerful of a thing that it can keep taking you down further down that road. It was a combination of all those things, and I'm just very, very thankful. I feel very blessed that I was able to see that at that time and realize that I needed to do something different.
We're talking to Chris Kirk. You mentioned your family. At one point when you were away from the game, you were the head coach of your son Sawyer's baseball team. You were the assistant mm-hmm. coach of your son Foster's team. So what was that experience like? And overall, what was the time away from the game like for you?
Just hearing you say that brings a big smile to my face. Remembering coaching their teams. And, I'll try to stay involved and at least be assistant coaches for them going forward. It was great. The first few weeks to maybe a month are really difficult. And I think that anybody else that's been through this can attest to that. Just physically, your body adjusting to not having something that it's had every day for a long time is difficult. And mentally also, you become kind of obsessed, I guess is the right word, where you have, it's a thought that pops into your head every 5 or 10 minutes all day. And that part of it doesn't necessarily go away at first. And you feel like it'll never go away. But thankfully it has. But once I was able to get through those first few weeks, just being able to spend time here at home with my wife and kids. We live on 40 acres here in Athens, Georgia. It's just an awesome place for us to hang out. Really got into my physical fitness, got in the best shape of my life, which I could probably use a little bit more of that now. I need to get back going on that. But, just the time at home was fantastic. All that extra time with my kids. It just was something I'll never forget, and a time that that you could see as a huge negative, but now I look back on it with really fond memories.
We're talking to Chris Kirk. Chris, one last thought about your reaction to this and how you got leverage on this. I think this is a statement you made last fall. Well, I know the statement was made last fall, but I think a lot of people would really like to hear this because it would resonate. You said alcohol is not your problem. It is your solution. You just have to find a better solution, end quote. I think that's really interesting. I think people would benefit from hearing your thoughts on that. Can you lay that out? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that a lot of people who become alcoholics or addicts or whatever it may be, you're using your drug of choice to make you just feel better about yourself, or if you have anxious or depressed thoughts, to kind of turn the volume down on those. That's certainly how it was for me. I think that I was spending a ton of time on the road away from my family, which I didn't like. And I think that just trying to maintain the high level of golf that I had been playing, and the struggle to do that just became too much for me. And so my sort of anxious thoughts would build and snowball, and I would come up with all these crazy, unrealistic scenarios in my mind. And so drinking was a way for me to just get those to turn off for a while, you know? And unfortunately, they would come back the next day, but it was worth it for me at the time to be able to just sit there and stare at the wall and not think about anything. And so obviously I got to the point where I realized that it wasn't really working anymore. And I've been able to find other solutions. You know, I'm involved in a 12-step program that's been really life-changing for me. And just seeing that, you know, although there were some actions on my part that brought this on, it's not necessarily something that I need to blame myself for, and not even something that I regret anymore, because it's led me to a place where I feel so much more free and open and honest than I've ever been. It's just an amazing feeling.
Talking to Chris Kirk, I appreciate that response very much. So as I mentioned, you had previously won 4 times on the PGA Tour, a couple of times on the Korn Ferry Tour. So how does this win feel compared to the ones before it? Does it feel different because of everything you've been through and overcome?
Certainly, yes. And, you know, it's been 5 years since I've won a Korn Ferry or PGA Tour event. So, definitely feel some feelings of redemption, but also I feel like it, you know, I'm hoping on this just being a stepping stone to being back where I want to be, being, you know, one of the top players in the world again. And I believe I have the game to do it. It's a matter of trying to, you know, stick with my program and stay in a good place mentally and physically, and just try to slowly start building some confidence and realize that I can still do this.
Hey Chris, one last thought. What about the PGA Tour family? Like, what was the response from people around the game when you announced that you were taking your leave of absence, and what has the response been like since you've come back?
Overwhelmingly positive on both accounts. From all the other players that have sent me messages of support and just saying that they really respect what I'm doing, and I really appreciate that. And then obviously this past week, tons of congratulatory calls and text messages, and then the support from the PGA Tour itself, from Jay Monahan. He called me a few days ago just to tell me congratulations and how proud he was of me, and they've just been really fantastic. It really does feel like a family in times like this.
All right, so Sunday night we had the disgusting news from NASCAR that a noose had been found in the garage stall of the 43 team at Talladega. The 43 car, of course, is driven by Bubba Wallace, the only black driver in the Cup Series, and a man who had spoken out against the Confederate flag at NASCAR events. The fact that Sunday's race had been postponed until Monday took a literal backseat to that news. As I said yesterday, this has been an ugly few months for the sport. From a driver using a racial slur to the banning of the Confederate flag and the response to that, including that flag and that defund NASCAR banner, which was flown over the track and now you have the noose. And disgustingly, it didn't end there. According to reports, officials at Sonoma Raceway in California said they're investigating, quote, a piece of twine tied in what appeared to be a noose that was, quote, found hanging from a tree on Raceway property, end quote, over the weekend. Then on Monday, we had this response from NASCAR.
All of NASCAR's drivers have rallied around Bubba Wallace, the NASCAR Cup Series lone black driver, after what happened here yesterday afternoon. The drivers, led by reigning Cup Series champion Kyle Busch in green, and their crews, the entire garage area, has rallied around Bubba Wallace and the number 43 today.
So that was an amazing scene. Powerful, moving, incredible. All 39 drivers pushing Wallace's car, the 43, once driven by Richard Petty, to the front of the line before the race, and they were followed by their teams. Every competitor in the sport standing behind Bubba Wallace and having his back. Then when Wallace gets out of the car, you can see the impact it had on him. Tears, full body shakes, he wept. He rested his head on the roof of the car as he got out to try to collect himself. And then one driver after another came to hug him. That's how you respond. That's a statement, not just from the sport's governing body, but from everybody involved. That's every driver and their crew stepping up and saying to whoever put that noose in the garage, you may think that we agree with you, and you may think that that attitude is welcome here, but it's not. We're siding with Bubba Wallace, not you. You're garbage. It's so much better than each driver coming up with a carefully crafted statement from a public relations consultant that they drop on social media. According to reports, it started in a driver's chat when Jimmy Johnson said that he was going to stand with Bubba Wallace during the anthem. Then Kevin Harvick said the drivers should actually push Wallace's car to the front. And then they were joined by Richard Petty, the 82-year-old legend and owner of the car, who had not come to the track during the pandemic, but flew to Alabama for yesterday's race. That could be a serious health risk, but as Petty said, quote, the most important thing for me right now is hugging my driver, end quote. And you can see the emotions for Wallace and what it all meant to him. Johnson later was to say this.
I'm happy to play a role in it. I want to. I know I need to. And I feel like to see the garage area stand up as they have as well in the last few weeks and then again today is just sending a very strong message, and I'm very proud of our sport.
Jimmy Johnson. And by the way, the race was damn good too. Bubba Wallace and the 43 were running really well. They were running up front, in fact, for most of the day and leading with 30 laps to go. For a while, it looked like he might have a chance to rip that thing until he needed to pit late for fuel. Then Ryan Blaney, who is going to join us next hour, won it in overtime by a nose. That was a wild ending, including cars bouncing off of each other. And you can imagine as tight a finish as you could possibly imagine, in fact.
But up front, they're racing for the win.
Blaney's
ahead.
Crashes
in the back, and Blaney is the leader. Stenhouse comes back to him on the bottom. Off turn four, three wide.
Not over yet. Here comes Eric Jones.
Nemechek trying to push Jones. Eric Jones with help. Here comes Almirola. Crash into the wall. I think it's Stenhouse. It might be Blaney.
Oh, my goodness. They were, what, three, four wide?
Man, that was wild. Wild finish. So tight, 0.007 seconds. 0.007 seconds. 007, Blaney going James Bond on that. You translate that time into distance, Blaney edges out Ricky Stenhouse Jr. by roughly a foot, if that. So if that was your first introduction to NASCAR, if you had tuned in to see how the sport might respond, you got a great response and an amazing race. Like, the cliche thing would be to say that Bubba Wallace or NASCAR as a whole was the real winner yesterday, but it's true. Even though Wallace finished 14th, he was the star of the show. He made a statement with how he ran during the race, and he made an even bigger statement after the race when he took off his mask and he walked across the track to greet some new NASCAR fans who reportedly drove from Atlanta to Talladega for that race wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts and pressing up against the fence so they can meet him.
Bubba, I don't know if you can hear me, but what a day. NASCAR rallies around you. You got fans in the stands.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you.
This moment.
This is probably the most badass moment right here. I'm proud to stand where I'm at and carry a new face. Look at this. First time's right here from Atlanta. That is so cool. The sport is changing. The deal that happened yesterday, sorry I'm not wearing my mask, but I wanted to show whoever it was that you're not going to take away my smile. And I'm going to keep on going.
That was probably the most badass moment right there. And there were a number of badass moments yesterday. The statement NASCAR released on Sunday was strong. The statement that the sport made yesterday was even stronger. That was badass. That was cool. That was tremendous. We are joined by Ryan Blaney. Ryan, it's great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Ryan, great to have you on, especially after yesterday. Well, any day, but especially after yesterday. What an amazing win that was at Talladega. Can you take me through the final moments as cars are bumping into each other? Everybody's battling for that win. What's going through your head in those final seconds?
Yeah, you know, any race at Talladega or, you know, any super speedway is always going to be exciting. Just we're so close to each other and, you know, you're fighting for inches and you have moments to react and, you know, in our position, when we came off of turn four, we were kind of too far ahead. I didn't really have any drafting help. So it's that time you're just trying to block the runs that are coming to you. And it's just what you got to do. And, you know, there was some beating and banging there coming to the line. But, you know, at that time, it's you know, the gloves are off and you got to do what you got to do to win. Any competitor will tell you that. So it was an exciting race, exciting finish. It was nice that we were on the good end of it for sure. And winning by 2 or 3 inches is definitely really exciting. You definitely get your heart going.
We're talking to Ryan Blaney. I was going to say, you and the team have been running really well of late. You've been knocking on the door for a win for the past three races leading up to yesterday. So you touched on this, but how good did it feel to punch that one in and get that win when you had been running as well as you had and come so close?
Yeah. We've been, you know, really fast all year. We've been really had really fast race cars and been so close, especially the last month and a half. We've had some great finishes and, we've been, like you said, knocking on the door of our first one of the year and just haven't quite been able to pull it off. And it was nice to finally get one yesterday and just get that zero out of that column. And hopefully this opens up, you know, the floodgates for many more to come this year. But it's just been, you know, being with a new team this year, a new group of guys is it's taking a little bit to get used to, you know, especially with no practice now, with the way everything's working. It's hard to get a feel for everybody, you know, and it just takes time. But I've been fortunate. I've been having a blast this year, and I think we've been really strong. It's just a matter of, you know, cleaning a few things up, and hopefully we can keep rattling off wins and good finishes here in the regular season that, you know, lead us to the playoffs.
See, Ryan, that's the thing. It seems to me that, I mean, you're talking about the challenge of coming together with a new team, but the fact of the matter is you're having a really good year and running really well, and you are with a new team. You're with your first season with crew chief Todd Gordon. It seems like it looks easy. I know it's not, but how have the two of you been able to get on the same page as quickly as you have?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. It's, you know, we had the first four races of the year with normal schedule, and then, you know, the virus happened, and with just showing up and racing now, that's hard to get good communication going. You know, through practice, you can really get a feel for each other and, okay, what he figured it out, what I like with the race cars, I figure out what he likes to change on them, and you got to get your own communication. So, and that just takes time. But, you know, with me and Todd, that's been really quick. It's been a really quick learning curve. We get each other and, you know, we kind of have our own language when it comes to the cars, which just works. And, like I said, he's a great crew chief. He's a championship crew chief. That whole group won the championship a couple of years ago. So just a really great group of guys. But, it's definitely been nice to fire off the season really strong. And you just hope that it keeps getting better and better as you keep getting to know each other.
Ryan Blaney with an amazing win yesterday. Of course, before the race, there was that incredibly powerful scene where all the drivers pushed Bubba Wallace's car to the front. You and Bubba have been friends for a long time. Let me ask, what kind of emotions did you have when Bubba told you about that noose in the garage on Sunday?
Yeah, the pre-race was definitely a special moment to be a part of. You know, with not only the drivers coming together and showing their support, but the crew members, NASCAR, the fans that were there, you know, showing their support for Darrell was just nice to be a part of. And it just shows that, you know, we're all in this together. And it goes away from a competitive and a sports standpoint. That's just humanity, you know, and caring for your fellow human being. And, you know, you hope that other people around the world and around this country, you know, see that and learn from it. But when he, you know, when I found out about that incident that happened, you know, I was obviously really hurt for him. And, you know, I've known Bubba for 15 years and he's been one of my best friends along the way. And I've always supported him and always will support him till the end of time. But I know he was hurt by it. And I just don't understand the how someone can have hatred like that in their heart, you know, to do something like that. But, you know, I think the way that, you know, you fight it is showing that you're not going to back down. And he's done a great job in not backing down and really voicing himself and just really, you know, supporting movements that are going on right now. So it's been nice to, you know, be a part of it with him and learn, you know, from him and things like that. But it's a special moment before the race. That was really nice to be a part of. And I hope, you know, people can learn from that, you know, around the world and just support your fellow human being, man. That's what it takes. You just have to, we're all in it together. And we wanted to show that yesterday. And you know, like I said, just a special moment to be a part of with him and all the other drivers.
Absolutely right. Ryan, one quick follow. After the race, you said that you and the drivers wanted to show, quote, "We're not going to take it anymore. I'm getting sick of this bleep," end quote. Does it feel like this was a really significant moment for the sport?
I think so. You know, I mean, yeah, I definitely think so. It's just, you know, the support that the sport has given and Bubba's given to, you know, recent events that's happened in the country, you know, the past 3 or 4 weeks. You know, we just want to show our support that, like I said, it just goes back to supporting your fellow human being. And, you know, no matter where you come from, no matter what color skin you are, we're all on the planet Earth. And you all have to, everyone has to get along and things like that. So I think, you know, people coming together is the best way to just overcome, you know, hatred in the world and in the country. And, you know, so I definitely think we just, you know, want to do what's right. You know, we're not doing it for publicity. We're not doing it for anything like that. It's just doing what's right and standing up for what you think is right on the humanity side. So I thought, like I said, it just goes back to it was a really special moment yesterday. And, you know, like I said, I'm going to be behind my buddy 100% along the way.
I appreciate your thoughts. Before you go, this Saturday and Sunday is the first time ever that the Cup Series is going to host two Cup events on back-to-back days. It's going to be a challenging weekend, an exciting weekend. What kind of thoughts do you have when you think about the weekend?
Yeah, it'll be a really special weekend for sure. Like you said, it's the first time we're, you know, doing a doubleheader and Cup races at the same track, you know, Saturday, Sunday. And they're inverting, you know, the top 20 in the field after Saturday's race. So that'll be a big shakeup in the starting lineup for Sunday. So I think it'd be great. You know, it's a shame we can't have a stands packed full of fans like we were looking forward to. But, you know, I think it'll be great to watch on TV. The races are a little bit shorter, so it'll be a little bit more of a quick dash to the finish. And Pocono puts on a great race, too. It's a really unique big triangle racetrack, and no corner's the same. So I'm excited for it. It'll be definitely an interesting one running the same car both days. And hopefully you don't tear your car up on Saturday and have to fix it for Sunday. But I hope everyone enjoys it. I know I will.
All right, so last thought. You've had success there. And like you said, it's different running without the fans. But as everybody knows, you are an aspiring Jedi. Take me inside. What is the mindset that you have to have, especially at the end in those tight finishes? How are you able to stay so focused during those pressure-packed moments?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's you live to be a competitor, you know, in any sport that you do. And, you know, at those racetracks, that when it's coming down to crunch time, there's a lot of things happening, you know, and you have split seconds to make a decision. And you hope it's the right decision. You'll make wrong decisions sometimes, but you try to learn from those. But everything just happens so fast. You know, you have a split second to make your mind up and what you're going to do, and you hope it's the right move to make. So your mind's just always thinking ahead. You know, I think that's the best thing you can do is always thinking towards, you know, 30 feet ahead of you instead of right where you're at. That's just kind of how you have to think. And said sometimes they work for you, sometimes they don't. But you just try to get better at it and do the best you can. But it's definitely exciting, and I've been fortunate to be a part of it. You know, for many years, the racing side of it, and just what I live for is what I grew up watching my dad do, and really fortunate to be a part of it nowadays.
There you go. For the first time ever, the NASCAR Cup Series is going to hold two cup events back-to-back. On Saturday and Sunday, you've got the Pocono Organics 325 on Saturday, the Pocono 350 on Sunday. Ryan Blaney is the driver of the number 12 Menards Ford Mustang for Team Penske. Ryan, great win yesterday. Great to have you on the show. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thanks, sir. Appreciate you having me.
Let's go to Matt in L.A. Matt, what's going on, Matt?
Romy, thanks for the vine. Congrats on another stellar smack off, pimp. Mad respect to Laughing Laguna and Trapper and Dana Point. But that's not why I called, Jim. I called because the record must be set straight. And your boy Matt in L.A. spits facts in his smack, unlike these pretenders. So as soon as I heard Jowls and Richmond talking about rolling fatties, I knew that the heaviest player with no game was laying it on hip boot dick from the get-go, because dude's pizza dough slab palms looked like they sprouted cigars as digits. The truth is, Jowls the kielbasa claw can't roll a pair of dice with those swollen mitts, much less dubage. But in a show of honor, I'm inducting Jowsy into that aged-old jungle community, the Fat Family, along with 2020 class members, Wellsrith in a 3XL and Shawnee in Send a Gas Grill. You oversized oafs need to be recognized for your achievements in obesity in 2020. And speaking of Shawnee just grabbed an age tam, how does it feel to have five crowns like the B.I. Sleaze, but less Jungle Cage winnings than left? Or the aforementioned team helmet head captain, Bradley from the IE. So, Shawnee, take your worthless quintet, ring pop, plastic trinkets you got, because in today's jungle, you're a has-been. And a Danny DeVito penguin doppelganger on your best day, you puke. That's all I got, Jim. Outro.
Matt in L.A. Appreciate you, Matt. Kevin in New Orleans. Kevin, what's going on?
Hey, what's going on, Jim?
What's up? How you doing?
Oh, I'm all right, my man. First time, long time. I'm listen to the first call. I got Matt. Dude, that is awful. I don't know. He's unlistenable. In fact, I'm like the old school. I'm from way back in the day. I've never called before. And these new callers, I don't know. Some of them sound like a mix between Jeff in Richmond and Means with those awful songs from back in the day. I like like Terrence and all those guys. That's all I just really wanted to say. I was just calling to tell your call screener there. He said come on the radio and mention that. But hey, let's get back to the old days. These new guys suck. It sounds like the last guy. I remember back in the day you used to say stop reading your facts. Well, that sounded like what he was doing. Why didn't you run him?
My man, I got you, Kevin. I feel you. I appreciate it. Thanks, Kevin. All right, so that's Kevin in New Orleans. He's like, hey, come on, man. Come on, Rome. What's going on, Jeff? How are you?
Thank you for the vine, Jim. Jim, I've updated my Cal in Vegas impersonation. It now sounds like this.
Hey, I tell you, I don't get no respect. I don't get no respect at all. Hey.
That was a great call, Rodney. Hey, Jeff in Richmond, it's not who wants to walk with Jeff in Richmond. It's who wants Jeff in Richmond to walk. And the answer is your doctor, because you're fat, Jeff. Seriously, Jeff, your veins have more clogs than Matt in L.A.'s work week. But you know who doesn't want you to walk, Jeff? Your trophy wife. She wants you to shotgun a keg of melted butter. That way, when you drop dead, she can have all of your money instead of just having all your bros. Hey, Jim, here's a joke for all the Star Trek geeks. Hey, Lef, I was trying to remember where I've seen you before, and then I remembered. You were on Star Trek where you played a dude named Ferengi. What's up, Ferengi? And lastly, Jim, hey, Brad and Corona, here's what your photo says about you. The banana hammock says you have junior league junk. The cigar says you're insecure about your junk. And the hat and sunglasses say you're embarrassed to be you. You should be embarrassed, Brad. You have 5 crowns, and all you have to show for it is fast-tracking your gimp onto the hack-off watch list. Hey, Reggie, you're not just Brad's bitch. You're his gimp. Get back in your box, bro. I honestly can't stand you dudes and your whiny Jeff and SoCal voices. You remind me of the Dead Milkman song, Bitchin' Camaro. Except in your case, it's called Bitchin' Corona. Bitchin' Corona, Bitchin' Corona, I'm gonna drive Brad's car, bum bum bum. Bitchin' Corona, Bitchin' Corona, I'm gonna drive it real hard, bum bum bum. Bitchin' Corona, Bitchin' Corona, I'm gonna shift a stick, bum bum bum. Bitchin' Corona, Bitchin' Corona, I'm gonna ride that, woo! Bitchin' Corona, Bitchin' Corona, ba-da-da-bam-ba-da-bum.
Wow. All right, 2 thoughts. Let me save you the trouble. Where was that on Friday?
Good night,